The notion that Trump is a destroyer can, on one level, just sort of satisfy an anti-establishment drive that a lot of his supporters have, of course, that, you know, the system is screwed, let's just toss a bomb into it. And that bomb, the original hope, I think, for those people was that it would be Trump. But there is a possibility for a deeper esoteric notion of Trump, and to explain that, we have to go back to that time cycle that I was talking to you about earlier. There are those who see that time cycle as just a self-propelling system that is simply fate. It can actually be charted in terms of years. But there were other figures in and also adjacent to traditionalism who saw it rather as being a potentiality, or rather you can almost think of it as a sort of circular railroad track that really would need someone to push it forward in order to get to a certain destination. You couldn't really go backwards, you couldn't change its course, but it could slow down or speed up, I'd say. And the actual method of acceleration is destruction.
Hey everyone, this is your host Isaac. Today we're gonna be joined by a special guest. We don't do special guests too often, but this one I thought was very curious, and I thought you would enjoy a nice, refreshing guest. This one definitely lays into a lot of the concepts we've been talking about. Surprisingly so. You get all these offers for different guests, and typically my schedule is too tight to find a way to, you know, make it work, but obviously I've got time right now. But this one, at first I thought, you know, this doesn't really seem to fit the show, but then I read a little bit more into it, and oh yeah, it fits the show. We're talking about Professor Benjamin Teitelbaum and his latest book, War for Eternity, Inside Bannon's Far-Right Circle of Global Power Brokers. And I know what you're thinking, no, is this some stuffy geopolitics kind of show? No, it's not. It's, you know, if you don't know who Steve Bannon is, I would recommend you do a brief Wikipedia review. Long story short, he was the guy who helped President Trump get into office. He's been accused of being, too alt-righty, working for Breitbart. But yeah, we talk about him, and you won't believe the connections here between Trump, Steve Bannon, and the esoteric doctrine of the occult. Our guest is a professor at the University of Colorado Boulder and has written extensively on the far right. He sat with Steve Bannon for many, many interviews, and he peels back an interesting parallel to a philosophy that supports many of these occult concepts we've been looking at over the years for evolving mankind into a new age. Doesn't that sound familiar? The concept of a dark age called the Kali Yuga, in which materialism reigns supreme. We'll find out why Steve Bannon and company want to destroy this cycle of time and move into the next phase, which is called the Golden Age, which you should recall from, I think, in my first book, I talked about the Golden Age. And then we also see, of course, how does COVID play into all this destructive cycles for the elite? You know, we've got many surprising links between Steve Bannon, traditionalism, the far right, Golden Age, alchemy, Kali Yuga. There's several occultists brought up on the show, Julius Evola, Rene Guénon, and George Jurdeff. And of course, chaos magic. We talk about Pepe the Frog. So enjoy the show. If you like the show, leave a great review on the iTunes. I know I said I'd stop begging for them, but at this point I would say if you want to support the show, go to patreon.com/IlluminatiWatcher. But I know many of these are not in the greatest financial position to do that. So drop a review on iTunes if you like the show. Let me know. All right, I've got Professor Teitelbaum. He is the author of a book called War for Eternity, Inside Bannon's Far-Right Circle of Global Power Brokers. Good morning. How are you doing over there, Professor?
I'm doing well. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. Thank you for taking your time with us. This is quite an interesting book you've got here. At first glance, I kind of thought this was going to be you know, a little too geopolitical kind of for me personally. But then I kind of combed through some of the ideas here, and I can see how there's a lot of relevance to my audience here. So I wanted to get you on here to clarify some of these points, and we can kind of get into different elements of this book and the ideas that you're presenting. Now, as far as, let's get briefly into your background here, because you've got a particular focus area. You're a professor at University of Colorado Boulder with write-ups in New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and so on. But you've got a specialty in the contemporary far-right movements. What drew you into that?
Well, it's even a little stranger yet, I'm afraid.
Isaac, strange is good for us.
Good. That's why I was so excited to join you on this show. It actually began with folk music. Oddly enough, the plan was way back when that I would be studying Swedish and Scandinavian traditional music. And that's what I had trained for, and I went off to do my research as a graduate student in Sweden. And I was going to write a dissertation on asymmetrical rhythm in Swedish dance music, rural Swedish dance music. It was going to be a very, very good dissertation, I promise you, but no one would have read it. and when I was there, though, this was 2010, right at that moment, an anti-immigrant nationalist party in Sweden started what ultimately became an explosion of popular support and a complete transformation of the political scene in the country. And they were at the very, very beginning stages. It was a party that, unlike a lot of others of this kind in Europe, had come straight out of the cultural, also somewhat the ideological, sphere of skinheadism, you know, kind of neo-Nazi white power music. And you know, that's how many Swedes knew them. It's one reason why they were so horrified by the growth of this party. It wasn't necessarily because their official party platform was so radical, but it was about their kind of cultural affiliations, that these were skinhead hooligans who had just broken into their national parliament. The thing was, when that was going on, this party suddenly, when it's coming into power, suddenly starts wanting to fuel significant amount of money to Swedish folk culture and Swedish folk music in particular. And so I'm there, and I have this research project that I had been excited about, but I knew was not, you know, going to be that politically rich or engaging. And all of a sudden this happens, and I decided to start following the reasons why this particular party turned to folk music and what they were doing there. I imagine all that because right in that moment, I started to get some insight into the ways that culture, ideology, expressive culture, identity in the far right was in a moment of transformation, rather. And that things were changing and that we might not even really know how this would play in society and what ideas were going to be drawn from, who they would speak to. And that's been my life since then. I've been following that. I study music when it's relevant. When it's not, I turn into ideology. I don't do a ton of geopolitics. This is a kind of a new topic for me, but the whole project has been to try and understand better and better and go deeper and deeper into this political cause.
Nice. Okay. Yeah, that's curious. I had I don't know how relevant this is to the conversation, but there was I was getting a tattoo by one artist several years ago, and her boyfriend was there, and he was from Sweden. And in my naive head, I thought all Swedes kind of like had a, you know, stereotypical look of, you know, whatever, blonde hair, blue eyes kind of thing or something. And this is like the biggest, scariest biker looking dude. And I was in the chair, and he had, you know, covered in tattoos of all kinds of sort of borderline white power stuff. And he was going on and on about all these racist ideas. And I'm just sitting here like trying to entertain it as much as I could without, without calling the scene. Cause I was trying to, I had nowhere to go, but yeah, that's curious.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that, yeah, I mean, Sweden, it's, you know, at the for quite a while at the level of official politics, you know, the people who are representing their government, you know, it's one of the most left-leaning progressive countries in the world, but in its underground, it has one of the largest, you could say, reactionary undergrounds in the West. Had you know, per capita, by far the largest producer of white power music. And like you say, the biker gangs, a huge deal. Bandidos, Hells Angels. You don't think, you know, most people when they hear Scandinavia, they think of sweaters and, you know, single payer healthcare and things like things
exactly.
Like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, okay. So that's interesting. And then in this book, specifically, War for Eternity, you focus on basically some, and there's kind of different areas I imagine you could take this conversation, but my sort of overview of this book is that it's about sort of understanding Steve Bannon, who I'm going to assume most of the audience knows who that is. You know, I had my opinions on this guy a couple years back, and then he was on Bill Maher, real time with Bill Maher, I don't know, 6 months ago-ish. And I remember he was saying stuff that I was kind of like, oh, this isn't the guy I thought he was. Like, it was kind of weird. But I never researched him, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't know much about the guy.
Yeah.
Now, you've sat down, you've met with this guy several times. What do you think of him? What's your take on him? Are you guys friends? That kind of stuff.
I can't say that we're friends because we don't know each other that well. And there are so many differences between us that will take a special effort, I think. But I didn't come away hating him. And that's despite the fact that we have some pretty divergent political views. He's a paradox. Steve Bannon is a paradox, and that's probably going to be the key to keeping him in American life and in keeping our attention on him for quite some time. He's, in certain respects, he can seem like a blowhard and a phony and, you know, just a pure egotist with a lot of empty space inside. I can have a conversation with him that affirms all of those impressions. I can also come back the next day and we have a conversation and I'm just floored by, the depth and breadth of his reading and his knowledge. The fact that he can be so unpredictable in his ideas. And I think that's partially what you're speaking to when you talk about the appearance on Bill Maher, and also extremely effective in what he does. At the same time as, again, sticking with the paradox theme, you can look back through his history and see so many failures too. You know, imploded plans and, you know, destroyed initiatives and things like that. But, the one thing that is very consistent with him that is always going to stick with me is that I think he has more energy in him than really just any person I've ever been around. And it's not even close. I mean, it's an experience to sit and spend 3 hours with him talking in depth about a topic. Just that you sense that from him, that he is, for in some respect, a remarkable person who does deserve that, at least the attention, not necessarily praise for that fact, but he's an exceptional character.
That's fascinating. You know, this book, as I was reading through it, you know, I did sort of that proverbial jaw drop throughout the book, because, yeah, like you're saying, I mean, I was shocked by the amount of sort of, you know, thought he's putting into his worldview, which we can just get into, I suppose. Is it fair to say that this book is about, you know, a combination of sort of like Steve Bannon and the alt-right and their sort of motivation of what propels them? And to me, it goes into this idea of a concept, a philosophy, I should say, of traditionalism, which I, to be honest, didn't understand what that was. I just heard, you know, I hear the term traditional and I just think, oh, this is the, you know, the Trump, let's go back to the 1950s stuff. But there's a whole bit of a scene you've got in the book regarding the definition of traditionalism. And I'd like to hear your thoughts on what that is and what does Steve Bannon think this is, this traditionalism philosophy?
Yeah. Wait, every time I've asked him to define it, you know, the definitions that he gives, they're correct in a sense. I think a lot of others would agree with them, but they also can let you know how hard it is to define what this thing is. He says traditionalism is a school of thought opposed to modernity, against the modern world, and for immanence and transcendence.
Interesting.
There you go. So, and this is not the sort of thing, if we start out like that, you can imagine what my academic colleagues in political science would think. If I were to tell them that this was relevant to politics, the question would be, you know, what the hell? That's not a political platform. Who knows what that is? And indeed, traditionalism was not devised actually as a political ideology. In fact, there are, you know, plenty of traditionalists in history and today, people who affiliate with this way of thinking, who absolutely think that it has no business being in politics. Granted, that comes from an ideological position that politics today is corrupt necessarily by necessity of it being part of the modern world. So traditionalism, it emerges really from a figure named René Guénon, although he would say that it has always existed. But this was a French philosopher who was very interested and believed, as a number of religious thinkers have, that once in the past, ages ago, there was an actual true integral religion. And that as time went on, it was disintegrated, forgotten, you know, it's being committed to text, or attempts to commit religious teachings to text testify to the fact that it wasn't common knowledge anymore. And gradually it disappears into the world, and fragments of it might exist in a variety of religious teachings. And it's the task of the traditionalist to try and put those pieces back together. Not all religions, of course. There, Guénon and a lot of his followers saw certain religions as being tied to this eternal Ur religion, this perennial truth. And others that were not. And for him, Hinduism was key. I think it has to be said that a sort of second choice was Sufism in Islam, based mainly on the notion that Sufist practice had preserved pre-Islamic truths. Some similar arguments are made for Catholicism. Based on that searching, they put together, you know, accounts of truth in the world. And I can, if I can keep going, Isaac, I'll get to a couple more tangible, products of that that end up influencing politics. Yeah. So one of them, and your listeners who have studied Hinduism even casually might recognize this. One of them is the notion of cyclic time. The notion that rather than, human history existing in linear fashion, such that you have a discrete beginning or past that one never returns to, and a future that you are inextricably tied to advancing toward. These thinkers see history repeating itself always in all the elements that would matter. Specifically, they see a cycle of four ages moving from golden to silver to bronze and to dark before a cataclysmic event pushes society back to gold again. And right off the bat, you can tell that for them, they see time as being equal to decline and destruction and disintegration. Every moment that goes by pushes you further and further into darkness, save for that one split second when the time cycle restarts itself and you find yourself in gold. But then decay begins again. So it's a pessimistic and fatalistic view of time. But the question is also then, what makes something old and what makes something dark? And for them, here is where we see some of their responses scatter. There were some figures who thought that this was a sort of racialized distinction, that in the Golden Age there were distinctly Aryan populations who were separated and prioritized over others, and that as darkness encroaches on the world, that population is disintegrated and darkened, indeed. But one common thread throughout all of these thinkers, even those who Steve Bannon, for example, rejects that element of traditionalism. So he says to me, all of these thinkers can typically unite around the notion that in the Golden Age, values, cultural values, politics, social organization are all organized and devoted to spiritual pursuit. In the Dark Age, the age of utmost darkness, spiritual immaterial pursuit is replaced by materialism. The more material, the better, so to say. So you could have, that is an age of merchants, it's an age of slaves, it's an age of devotion to money, to physical goods, and ultimately to bodies. They see that in the realm of politics as an opposition between theocracy, let's say, and democracy or communism, the latter two being rule by masses of bodies, essentially, an opposition between quality and quantity. And the last thing I would mention, as we're introducing ourselves to this also, is that whereas they typically see the Golden Age as an age of hierarchy and differentiation among humanity and within societies, that is to say that different types of people are separated, sometimes in a vertical hierarchy, but sometimes also in a more horizontal, separate but equal sort of sense. All of those borders that would separate people, cordon off various positions, are eradicated in the growth of mass societies and the growth of mass political entities in the Dark Age. And thus, bringing about a Golden Age or living in a more virtuous sense involves breaking down mass construction, breaking down mass societies, breaking down, let's say, for example, the European Union, or the U.S. federal government, or the United Nations, or the World Health Organization, or global capitalism, anything that would lead to more localized, more segmented life is a hallmark of a more virtuous time.
Wow. Okay. So a lot of ideas sort of floating through my head right now, because originally where I wanted this conversation to sort of touch on was some ideas that I found as I was reading your book. I was researching traditionalism. I was researching some of these figures you speak of, like René Guénon and Evola. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. Julius Evola.
Yes.
There's all these figures, and George Jurdeff, all these figures that I've seen. I'm familiar with some of them based on my research into the occult and sort of this realm of conspiracy theory. And it seemed like there's some kind of connection, connection between this traditionalism outlook where you're talking about these cycles of time, we're in this destructive Kali Yuga stuff. And then now you're saying that, if I'm hearing you right, that one of the ideas for people that are into this are to break down these, what do you call it, the masses of bodies or whatever, where you, like the EU, for example, break down to have a more localized government. And when I study in your book, it makes reference to these ideas that the traditionalist sense is thinking that we lost our way because of modernity, and really we lost some kind of true spirituality that was, long gone. And I think of alchemy, which I believe is even referenced in the book. I could be wrong on that, but
yes.
In alchemy, it's all about breaking down and, rejoining. It's sort of like what you're talking about here with traditionalism. So I do want to ask if, I don't know your background on research in the occult, but some of the figures you mentioned have influence in this realm of the occult. Is there, and this might be too vague of a question, but like, what's your take on this strange connection that Steve Bannon has with the world of the occult and the traditionalism?
Well, I mean, There are a number of ways I can take this question. I mean, first, you're absolutely right to notice a link here. Julius Evola was very much a participant in what I understand to be occultism. Steve never wanted to join anything. He said that to me many times, that he never wanted to, join a club. And a lot of, contemporary occultism is socially practiced. He did associate a little bit with some circles involved in the preservation of Gurdjieff's legacy. Otherwise he was steering clear. I mean, where this enters with Steve, if we want to talk about occultism or esotericism, is in some senses a little bit more helpful, way to think about this, is that, let's say esotericism is about, recognizing, celebrating rejected knowledge, right? And that, if that's a general definition, the more specific one that is usually of more value to us, is to think about esotericism as engaging with knowledge that was rejected by Western modernity, so by Enlightenment era science. And we should recognize off the bat, and of course I don't want to group everyone who is interested in occultism or esotericism into one basket by any means. There's a lot of ideological diversity there. But one of the ways that you can go with that is to say, well, this is a particular avenue toward anti-establishment practices and viewpoints. If it's a rejection of some of the precepts of Western science, that can also be folded into a rejection of standard notions of expertise in our society. And it might be folded thereafter into rejection of elitism. That part of the path that Steve Bannon took between traditionalism and populism, as he calls it, which is an extremely unintuitive path. I mean, traditionalism, a lot of it is expressly elitist. Strives to see the creation of an elite, but he does have his own take on it. But for him, that's looking at his history, that's the red thread that I see, is that here was a person early on who was not satisfied with conventional religion, his all of his zeal for being a Catholic notwithstanding, and who was not ready to endorse the expertise of scientists, actually in other Christian experts in our society, and that led to an interest in alternative spiritualities. It led to an interest in occultism and in meditation and practice. And it, as unintuitive as that may feel to us, for him, it doesn't seem like a huge leap to have gone from that rejection of authority and modern authority to a populism that wants to see the political order destroyed.
The we were talking about the names, the curious names that pop up in this discussion on traditionalism. There was a name in here, Jason Giorgiani, that pops up, and you talk about this book, Prometheus and Atlas. And I looked into that a little bit, and this Giorgiani, of course, he's tied into the Aryan movement and, like Richard Spencer and stuff. And I haven't read the book, but Jason Colavito, I follow his research, and he did a review of the book, and apparently it makes reference to UFOs and the supernatural. Sounds eerily similar to Nazi Germanic occult belief systems. And then you even sort of like tease that there is some supernatural esoteric systems at play in all of this. And I couldn't help but draw these parallels to back to 2016, where and I don't know if you're familiar with this or not. It gets a little fringy, but there was this idea that Pepe the Frog was this meme going around that was tied into Trump. And I did a lot of research into that, and the idea is that Pepe the Frog is basically Keck, this Egyptian frog god of magic. And the idea was that people in these 4chan, 8chan, whatever forum they used, they were sort of playing with this idea of a meme through Pepe the Frog, because they were pushing to get Trump into office for reasons I won't speculate on. I don't know if it's just they liked chaos or whatever, but the idea was that it was connected into chaos magic. So I'm curious if you could, you know, provide some background on how the esoteric doctrines are connected into all of this. Do you see any connections between Trump, Pepe the Frog, Steve Bannon, the alt-right? Any ideas there of connection points?
You know, I don't. It sounds like you're more deeply read actually into Pepe than I am. I mean, of course, the phrase meme magic was thrown around quite a bit. Gary Lachman has written a book, I think, more closely focused on those subjects. But when you start talking about chaos magic and we start talking about chaos, there, that's a place where I can speak to what you're interested in. The notion that Trump is a destroyer can on one level just sort of satisfy an anti-establishment drive that a lot of his supporters have, of course, that, you know, this system is screwed, let's just toss a bomb into it. And that bomb, the original hope, I think, for those people was that it would be Trump. But there is a possibility for a deeper esoteric notion of Trump, and to explain that, we have to go back to that time cycle that I was talking to you about earlier. There are those who see that time cycle as just a self-propelling system that is simply fate. It could actually be charted in terms of years. But there were other figures in and also adjacent to traditionalism who saw it rather as being a potentiality, or rather you can almost think of it as a sort of circular railroad track that really would need someone to push it forward in order to get to a certain destination. You couldn't really go backwards. You couldn't change its course, but it could slow down or speed up, I would say. Mm-hmm. And the actual method of acceleration is destruction. It is the breaking down of the edifices and the facades and the mass organizations. And therefore, if you have a figure who comes into the world and actually, you know, real influential people have the potential to move it forward if they are destructive. And they don't need to know why necessarily, but they just need to destroy. This is part of the thinking of a woman named Savitri Devi, who was a European French Greek, who moves to India, converts to Hinduism. She had a concept of various figures who could interact with this time cycle. And the person that I'm just describing right there, that particular figure is called a man in time. If time itself is destruction and decay, then being and belonging to time means that you participate in that destruction. And the good thing about these figures, of course, is that they, you know, by destroying things, they actually push humanity closer to rebirth into a golden era. I mention all of this because in an offhand comment, I write this in the book, Steve Bannon briefly referred to Donald Trump as a man in time. And I had to, you know, that's a kind of a banal sounding phrase. I spoke to so many colleagues and friends and said, hey, would you ever call someone a man in time? Does that mean anything to you? Is that a casual thing you'd say? Or did it attest to the fact that he really knew, had read this stuff? And I never really got a clear answer for it. Although, you know, when he described Trump, he went on to describe someone who, you know, had a potential to disintegrate, destroy, destabilize, and who did not need to know why. Which all of those are the hallmarks of a man in time, the Savitri Devi season. So that's, you know, when you talk about chaos, that's not chaos magic per se, what I've been describing, but the growth of chaos with a purpose or apparent chaos, destruction, that's figuring into these visions undoubtedly.
Mm, Oh, you're scaring me, Professor. You're scaring me. now it's just very curious.
That goes in a different direction, but go ahead.
No, that's great. Because I think, just me personally, when I see Trump as a politician, I'm thinking like, I don't know, this guy doesn't really seem to know what he's doing. I mean, whether you agree with what he does or not, and I don't know my opinion on Trump yet. Most of the things he says and does, I disagree with, but every now and then he does something. I'm like, I kind of see what all the conspiracy right winger type folks like about him. And I'm like, eh, maybe he's okay. But then, my point being is that what you just said makes more sense than anything I've ever heard, where it's like, he is just there to break things down. He doesn't really need to understand the intricacies of it, because I don't necessarily think he would, especially because a lot of the arguments here for traditionalism and the idea that we're on this cycle, and as part of the cycle, we're in the dark age, the Kali Yuga, where modernism is there, capitalism, maybe it's, we're all materialistic, right? Is the idea that, and Donald Trump, I would assume, is pretty materialistic based on his wanting to flaunt wealth and whatnot. So that's kind of what was, as I was reading your book, was at the back of my mind. I thought, like, this doesn't make sense. Like, it seems like Steve Bannon would be wanting to be supportive of someone who's not very materialistic and more spiritual. So that makes sense that you say that, like, he's more of a destructor. He doesn't necessarily need to understand the intricacies of the philosophy.
No. I mean, when people say that Bannon sees Trump as a pawn, I won't put those words in my own mouth, but there's something to that, that he's a means to a different end rather than an end in himself. And one thing I have to take this opportunity, just because I don't know how many shows I'm going to be on when I can talk about this. But when you talk about Trump's persona, Isaac, and the fact that Trump appears as this materialistic figure, there is also an esoteric pathway towards celebrating that, believe it or not. Julius Evola, who you mentioned earlier, people call him a fascist. A lot of historians do, or a Nazi or something like that. And it's in some ways that's being all too charitable to him, because he saw himself as being beyond fascism. Saw fascism as a start. He looked at the aesthetics as much as the policies of Mussolini and Hitler. And he saw an aesthetics of militarism, and he saw the growth of a military state, and he saw earthly secular immaterial values, heroism, bravery, honor, things like that. And he thought, wow, this is almost perfect. This is a step away. He thought that Italy at the time was headed forward on the time cycle into communism or democracy from plutocracy, from an age of the merchant, essentially. And then you see these archetypes of military figures emerge, and he thought, okay, we have this moment. Mussolini and Hitler are actually reversing time. What I need to do is get to Mussolini and Hitler and enchant them. Turn them into priests and make this not a military state, but a theocracy. And then we will have reversed time. We will have gone backwards up the hierarchy, backwards through time. And it is a little, so bearing that in mind, of course, things didn't work out for Mussolini and Hitler and all them. And Julius Evola becomes kind of resigned after that. Almost get the impression he felt it was foolish to believe that time could be reversed. But if you think of the United States, the way the hierarchy, I should mention, the golden age in traditionalism, golden, silver, bronze, dark. Golden age is the age of a priest. Silver is the age of a warrior. The bronze is the age of a merchant. And the dark is the age of the slave. And to suddenly in the United States, a society, devoted to liberal democracy, to suddenly see the specter of a merchant return, could be, if when we're wanting to interpret things in that way, could be seen as a sort of an eschatological indication that time was moving backwards. and that the United States was potentially moving from the Dark Age backwards into the Bronze, and that the next step would be a military state, and after that, a priestly state. So all of this is to say there are a number of ways to look at this in terms of traditionalism and in terms of its esotericism.
Fascinating stuff. Now, man, there's so many ways we can go this. I know your time is running short, so I'm going to cut to my last question. This is, obviously we have to talk about COVID. Why not? Right. We're all clamoring for more coronavirus talk, but I'd like to hear your take. And talking about Julius Evola, I was looking at an article you wrote back in 2017, called Julius Evola in the White House, and almost prophetically, which is scary to me, but almost prophetically, you quoted from a Politico article, and the quote is, "The view that technocrats have put Western civilization on a downward trajectory and that only a shock to the system can reverse its decline." Now, I mean, I'm a paranoid guy, but what are the connections we can make between COVID and with the traditionalist worldview and this concept you're talking about of the cycles of time and the people that could be, I don't want to say pulling the strings in the background, but people that would have a vested interest in COVID sort of pushing this destruction that the cycles of time calls for?
Well, it's very interesting, and it's actually after I published the book, I spoke to Dugan and Bannon about COVID because they've both been actually involved in commenting on it a lot. Bannon quite early. He was commenting on this in January. Started a radio show that's been going nonstop since then about the virus. The interesting thing is, for them, I won't speak for myself, but, for them, what Dugan has said is that, look at what types of behaviors are being rewarded and what ones are being punished. Is there a new, a new order of risks and rewards in the midst of this crisis? And the way that he sees it is that liberalism, globalization, the free movements of people, goods, monies, borderlessness, that system and those channels of exchange have now been laced with poison. And he called it, quote, a divine reprimand, as though, some sacred being, not an earthly conspiracy, but a sacred being was punishing the world for globalization, for creating that mass society. And opposite, on the other side, what was being rewarded was bounded societies, societies who could erect and maintain boundaries and borders, who could galvanize their members, who could mobilize and act collectively, typically in protection of their elders, first and foremost, in protection of personified history in the past, in other words. That's what's being shown to survive. At least that's how I see it. I don't want to start claiming to be an epidemiologist or something and know how all this works. But they see reinforcement for their worldview in this breakdown. Steve Bannon, when I relayed some of those words to him, he initially distanced himself from them. Dugan very expressly said that America in particular has to start choosing between liberalism and life now. And Bannon said, "Oh, America's going to do fine. Oh, but by the way, globalization, yes, is being punished. Globalism is being punished right now, and the strengthening of local communities and localism is what's going to be rewarded." So that's the depth that I've gotten from them on this topic. An interesting, parting note on that, Isaac, is to realize also how much that attitude pits, like Dugan and Bannon, against other conservatives, because really the people who are most alarmed and upset and most dismissive of the virus outbreak are both in the political right. You have kind of the more authoritarian voices wanting to see reaction shut down, the strong hand of government, And then you have the libertarian wing, which actually thinks very, very differently about society, about humanity, wanting to see the opening up of society and wanting to see individual freedom return. They both exist on the right for the time being, but this is, you know, for me as an analyst, I also see that this is a potential fissure that could rip apart and become much more consequential for the political right around the world if it keeps moving in this direction.
Fascinating. This is a wild topic. I could spend all day talking to you about this. By the way, I didn't know I'd have this much interest in Steve Bannon. But
yeah,
there's me neither. There's so many curious elements that you have cited in this book, and as I read, it just constantly was, you know, pinging off different ideas of areas of research. The book is called War for Eternity, Inside Bannon's Far-Right Circle of Global Power Brokers by Professor Benjamin Teitelbaum, and it is now on Amazon. I see it's doing very well. It's number one in the political category there right now. I'll post links to the book in my show notes and on my website. Professor, are there any social medias or websites you want to plug on the show real quick?
Oh, you know, I actually steer pretty clear of it.
Okay, smart man. Okay, all right. Well, I do want to thank you for your time.
Yes, likewise. Thank you.
I appreciate it. We'll see you.
All right, that was it. Again, if you like the show, drop a review on iTunes and let me know what you think. And you can check out his book on Steve Bannon, War for Eternity, on Amazon. I've got links on IlluminatiWatcher.com that will be in the show notes. And, you know, hit me up on the socials, all in the show notes. Instagram, at Isaac Weishaupt. Thank you for joining me on this special journey. And until next time, stay woke.